Next up on This Week in Law, law professor Aaron Perzanowski and startup founder Matt Homan join Sarah Pearson and me. We're going to talk about ownership in the modern age, Bratz dolls, tattoos, invisible boyfriends and girlfriends, and what they can tell us about why the unsullied go to brothels. All next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell and Sarah Pearson. Episode 299, recorded April 17th, 2015. He said, she said. This episode of This Week in Law is brought to you by Blue Apron. Blue Apron will send you all of the ingredients to cook fresh, delicious meals made with simple step-by-step instructions right to your door. See what's on the menu this week and get your first two meals free by going to blueapron.com/twit. That's blueapron.com/twit. And by FreshBooks, the super simple cloud accounting and invoicing solution that can help your law firm and any small business save time billing and get paid faster. Try it free at freshbooks.com/twill. Hi, folks. Denise Howell here, and you're joining us for This Week in Law. We're so excited that you are, because this is really, I think, as far as Sarah and I are concerned, and hopefully for you too, our favorite time of the week. It's when we get together with really, really smart people at the intersection of technology and law and help understand some of these very thorny issues that we all grapple with each day. They're issues that you may be paying a lot of attention to already, or issues that maybe you should be paying attention to because they can mean a lot to the way you live your life. So I mentioned my co-host, Sarah Pearson. She is with us here today. Hello, Sarah.
Hey, Denise. How are you?
I'm doing great. It's good to see you.
Good to see you.
So Sarah actually suggested that we bring on the show our guest today in the early part of the show. We may have another guest in the later part of the show. We'll talk about him later if and when he joins us. But with us here right now is Aaron Perzanowski. He is a professor at Case Western University Law School and has done a lot of really interesting thinking and writing on the current state of ownership in the digital age. Hello, Aaron.
Hey, good morning. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you, too. It's great to have you with us.
Yeah, it's great to be here.
So you have a very sort of wide-ranging array of interests and scholarship. I touched on the fact that you have written and thought a lot about copyright and how it should evolve in the face of the way we use and distribute media these days. You do some work in trademark, telecommunications. Anything else I'm leaving out?
I am probably the world's foremost expert on copyright issues related to tattoos, which is a distinction that did not require me to compete with very many people.
All right. And we definitely should talk about that today as well. Thank you for reminding me. Since we're going to talk about a lot of copyright issues, let's get right into that. Okay, Aaron, I teased the fact that you have some new and interesting and innovative ideas about how copyright law should evolve. Can you bring me from my vague generalities there into something more concrete?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, for the last several years, I have been writing a series of articles with my now frequent co-author, Jason Schultz. And what we've been interested in is this kind of transition that we're all living through right now, where we're going from a copyright and sort of media economy that, you know, up until 10 or 12 years ago was really based in the transfer of tangible goods of CDs and DVDs and hardcover books to a market and a culture where we acquire media primarily through digital means of distribution, whether that's paid downloads, whether that's cloud-based services or streaming services. And what we're really interested in is what the implications are of that transition for kind of the sense of ownership and personal property, right? So when you buy a hardcover book, it's like buying a pair of shoes or a new toothbrush. You own it. It's your personal property. You can give it away. You can transfer it. You can lend it. You can resell it, all those sorts of things. And copyright law allows for that through this notion of exhaustion or the first sale doctrine. That's why we have like used bookstores and eBay and all of these wonderful secondary markets. That sense of ownership and personal property gets a lot more complicated when we're no longer talking about tangible objects, but we're talking about rights in digital things that aren't even always in our possession. So, you know, people who buy a hardcover book stand in a very different sort of relationship with their purchases than someone who might buy an ebook. And that's something that's not obvious to a lot of consumers. And so we've been writing for a long time about this issue to an academic audience. We've written, I think, 4 law review articles at this point. And right now we're in the process of trying to translate these ideas into a much more kind of accessible format. So we're writing a book that's aimed at a much more general audience that tries to kind of tell the story in terms of how the law has shifted, how technology has shifted, and how sort of consumer behavior has shifted to lead us into this future where our rights in the things that we buy are far less clear and far more uncertain than they have been in the past.
Yeah, this has been something that's definitely been developing as media changes and terms of service around things that people quote unquote buy change. And why don't you tell us how you think we should tackle this issue?
Well, it's a complicated issue because there are a few different ways in which this story has developed, right? So one story is just about the way that the sort of means of distribution has changed. So we have, you know, this shift, right? So go as far back as you want to go, right? We can go back to the like Gutenberg press in 1450. From that point until about 12 years ago, we distributed creative works by making tangible copies. You know, and there are exceptions here and there, right? The movies, we would go and watch them in person. Theater, we would watch in person. But, you know, the music industry, the publishing industry, most of the major copyright industries were in the business of selling people tangible objects. That starts to change in like 2003. We get the iTunes store, which explodes in popularity. Then we get the emergence of cloud-based services. Now we're kind of living in this world where the growth is really happening in streaming services, Netflix and Spotify, those sorts of things, where there's really no argument that consumers own the things that they access. So part of it is about that change in distribution. We also have the rise of mass contracting, of end-user license agreements, of terms of service. And, you know, one of the few common traits of pretty much every end-user license agreement dealing with the purchase or the seeming purchase of digital media is that consumers don't own the thing that they have acquired, right? Even though Amazon has that shiny button that says, you know, buy now with one click, they don't really mean buy, right? They mean acquire a license to use this content under the terms that we lay out. So this is an example that's probably familiar to a number of your viewers. But a few years ago, Amazon gets in a dispute with a publisher about the rights to George Orwell's 1984. And thousands of people who had purchased Orwell's 1984 on the Kindle store wake up the next morning and their book is gone. That's not something you can do with people's hardcover books. You can't sneak into their homes in the middle of the night and take their books away. But that is something you can do in the digital environment. You can do it because of the technology, and you can do it in part because the terms of service give the providers, the retailers, in this instance, a lot of leeway and a lot of control over how you experience these these works. DRM is another component of that, right? It sort of takes those same sorts of restrictions that we might express in contractual terms, and it implements them in code that actually allows a provider to achieve those ends. So there's a kind of confluence of all of these things happening. In terms of what we do about it, there are some specific recommendations that we've made in our work so far, and I'm happy to talk about those in more detail. But at this point, I think the most important thing is just getting people to understand what's happening, because we all have these like deeply ingrained notions of personal property and ownership. That we've sort of absorbed through our lives as consumers, and they've been pretty consistent for the last few hundred years. And I think it takes a lot of people by surprise once they realize that their relationship with digital content is very different from their relationship with physical media. So I think at this point, the thing that I'm most focused on is just trying to get people to understand what's happening and kind of understand how we've arrived at this place.
I do want to get into what you and Jason are proposing as a way to approach this that's different than where we find ourselves now, which is sort of a confusing world where people's expectations are still, I think, on the ownership kind of side of things, whereas their actual rights to use the media they're consuming are far from that. And I want to get Sarah's take on this too. Do you think, Sarah, that philosophically, intellectually, people are ready to accept that shift from, here is the book that I bought and I own it and I can do anything I want with it. I can cut it up. I can lend it out. It's a physical thing that I own and can completely control and manipulate, to having a series of rights that hopefully gives them all the uses that they need, but still are going to have restrictions and limitations that maybe they don't anticipate.
No, I guess I don't think that they are. I think that they're unaware, because all of this stuff is buried in terms of service that no one reads. So that's why the 1984 disappearance came as a surprise to everyone, because no one read the terms of service that I'm sure, allowed for that to happen. So I think it's definitely something that consumers just aren't aware of. I think Aaron's right about that.
I do think that Aaron, you and Jason are onto something where, you've used the word control a couple of times, where if the control and the flexibility is sufficiently expansive, the people won't care about the shift away from ownership to simply having a series of usage rights that work for them. But that's a big if, isn't it?
I think it is a big if. I mean, you're seeing some recognition that these things are important to consumers. Amazon, in a very limited way, for example, has tried to incorporate the concept of lending into the Kindle store. So certain publishers have opted into this lending program that allows you, you download a book, you really like it, you think your sister or your best friend would really love this book, you can lend it to them, in a sense. There are important limitations that make that a very different kind of lending experience than what we're used to in the tangible world. First of all, it's opt-in, so most publishers aren't doing it. Second of all, you can only lend a book one time for 2 weeks. And once you've lent it out to one person, you can't turn around and lend it to someone else. So there's a recognition that consumers do have these expectations, and there's some limited effort, I think, to try to accommodate those expectations so we're not kind of bumping into those restrictions quite as often as we might be otherwise. But, my position is there's really no substitute for unregulated secondary markets. There's a whole host of reasons that we might be concerned about a system that allows lending but only allows it within one particular technological platform, about lending that depends on publisher permission. And you know, in the end, we might be able to train consumers to accept these sorts of restrictions. And I think that's probably the long-term strategy here. If you're a copyright holder or if you're a digital retailer, you want to get people used to living in this world to the extent that they kind of forget what it was like before, when you could do whatever you wanted with the materials that you purchased. And so that's why I think it's really important to intervene now and to make sure people see this happening. I'm not against consumer choice. If people don't want to own things, they don't have to own things. I don't buy movies, for example. I'm happy to be a Netflix subscriber to pay my monthly fee and watch what they make available. I don't think there's anything dangerous or wrong about that choice, but it has to be a choice. I have a very different relationship with music, for example. I've never used Spotify. I can see why people would, but I like to own that kind of media, in part because of, you know, kind of repeat, the value of repeat experience. So what I'd like to see is a marketplace where consumers have a genuine choice to make. And right now, what we're calling purchases in the digital media space, I think that's a real misnomer and is in fact kind of misleading to consumers. So one of the things I'm doing right now is working on a sort of consumer survey / consumer experiment where we try to test the expectations that are embedded in the language of buy now and contrast that with marketing language that is more reflective of what the end user license agreements and the terms of service say. That's still kind of in the early stages. But what I expect that to show is that consumers really do have a problem where they're kind of misperceiving the nature of these transactions, and they think they're getting something that they're not. So part of this, I think, can be clarified just through kind of more accurate, more honest representations of what these transactions actually are.
Right.
Yeah, I was going to say, it almost seems like you could go the FTC route if you're going to focus on the, you know, whether or not it's misleading and the notice angle. There's almost like an FTC potential claim there.
Yeah, and that's sort of the model that we're using in putting this survey together, right? We're testing those same sorts of things that you would be thinking about either in a false advertising context or sort of deceptive trade practices. One, whether there is a miscommunication happening, whether there are representations being made that are not accurate, whether people are interpreting that marketing language in a way that is inconsistent with the facts. And then secondly, whether that is material to people's decisions to purchase the stuff or not. It might be, yeah, we think that we get to lend it or resell it, but if it turns out we don't, we're not actually going to behave any differently. That's something that you can test. And I'm really interested. I have a hunch about what this means to consumers. But of course, I'm kind of projecting my own values onto the public. And it might turn out I'm wrong and people understand exactly what's going on, or it just doesn't matter to them. And if that's the case, then that's a useful piece of information. My suspicion is that it does matter to people, and that they are, at least a substantial number of them, are somewhat confused about what's actually happening.
It seems like we're assuming not just, you know, our own expectations of what the public might think, but also a degree of connectivity that allows everything to stream always. And while we're certainly getting toward that world and many people are living in that world, others don't, right? And so it's important to them to actually have something saved locally that they can call up and use and manipulate in a more facile manner than you could ever do with a stream. Do you think there's a way to sort of live in that bridge between the two worlds where we are right now, where we're not universal, excellent access to broadband does not quite exist?
Yeah, I think it's a problem. We are seeing instances where, you know, so far they're limited in number, but where digital distribution is becoming the exclusive means of distribution. I think it was just last week I saw that Fox has announced that future seasons of The Simpsons aren't going to be sold on disc. You can't buy it on Blu-ray. You can't buy it on DVD anymore. You can get it from Amazon or from iTunes. You know, if we live in a world where some material is only available through connected devices, I think there is a risk that we're excluding some segment of consumers, right? Maybe consumers who live in rural areas, maybe consumers who, you know, fall on the lower end of the income distribution, maybe people who just don't like to have, you know, constant internet connectivity. So I think that is a real problem. The other example, I guess, is, you know, Adobe's decision to stop selling its Creative Suite in a disk-based format, and now has kind of moved to the Creative Cloud model, where you get to pay Adobe a monthly fee as long as you want to use their product. So I am really concerned about that. I mean, on the one hand, digital distribution is has a lot to be said for it, right? It's oftentimes much more convenient. It's more cost effective. It's certainly better for the environment in most instances. But there's a trade-off here that I think we have to be aware of.
So tell us about the test that you and Jason have proposed to ensure that consumers have enough rights in this world of non-ownership.
So, you know, there are really two ways that you can go about resolving this problem. You can do it legislatively, and we have a short piece that recently came out in the Berkeley Technology Law Journal in a symposium issue from their Next Great Copyright Act symposium, I think from last spring, where we outline what a legislative solution would look like here, right? So you need two basic things. You need a test to tell you, so first sale and exhaustion apply when someone is an owner of a work. And ownership is sort of a tricky thing to define in this context. What we've seen in the world of software is that courts have been more willing to look at license agreements that say this is a license, not a sale, as undermining ownership, and we think that's problematic. You know, there are a few kind of telltale signs of what is a sale as opposed to the other kinds of transactions that don't lead to transfers of ownership: rental, leasing, lending. So, you know, one-time payment and perpetual possession is a pretty strong indicator that what you have here is a sale. So we think that should be the primary thing that courts are looking for in this context. We also think it's important to look at the marketing language to see how these transactions are presented to consumers. If you're going to call it a sale, if you're going to say, click here to own this thing, then we think that should have some relevance in the analysis. Even if what you have is an owner, you've got to figure out what rights come with that sort of ownership. Even in the sort of the world of hardcover books, owning a book gives you some rights. It doesn't give you all rights. You don't get to go out and make photocopies, right? Make 1,000 photocopies of the book you just bought and sell them on the street corner. You don't get to adapt the book into a movie just because you bought a copy of it. So what we think exhaustion is focused on is allowing the consumer to sort of extract the value of the thing that they paid for. That means having the right to use it, having the right to enjoy the work, having the right to transfer your interests to another party. Sometimes in the digital world, usually in the digital world, transferring the thing that you purchased is going to require making a copy, one or more copies. So it can't be limited just to distribution. It has to include the reproduction rate. It also has to include, we think, the derivative work rate to the extent that you might want to shift from one format to another. You buy an Apple iBook and you want to transfer it to somebody that only uses a Kindle. There might be some arguable derivative work made in that context. So we think exhaustion has to be a little bit broader. But we're worried about an exhaustion rule that's too broad, that actually undermines incentives for authors. So there might be some things that should be off limits that are not off limits in the world of tangible goods. Lending, for example, might work very differently. You could imagine kind of a distributed lending platform for ebooks, where one ebook can effectively be read by hundreds of people. And the ebook essentially just never has a down cycle. It's being read by someone all the time. And I think that would be really disruptive for the market for ebooks. So I don't know that we want the exhaustion rule to go that far. So, you know, we urge courts or Congress, whoever is making this decision, to, you know, look at the likely impact that applying exhaustion would have in a particular context. So our preferred solution is just to give this work to courts. Courts invented exhaustion and first sale. The first U.S. courts to articulate this principle did so, you know, in the 1880s, early 1890s. And it's a doctrine that was really developed at common law and was eventually reflected in the Copyright Act in 1909, but it has these judicial origins, and I think it's the kind of question where the flexibility and the context sensitivity that courts can bring to the table is much more useful than the kind of rigid formulas that we tend to get in statutory exceptions and limitations under copyright law. So I want courts to do this work. They're capable of doing this work. And I think that's probably kind of the ideal solution.
And I think you just answered a question that we had earlier from one of our listeners in IRC who asked, do we need Congress to create and pass a law that gives people the same rights of first purchase? I think maybe they mean first sale or exhaustion on digital goods as we have on physical goods. And you really think the courts are better suited for that?
I do think that the heavy lifting has to be done by courts. What we ended up proposing most recently was something that looks a fair amount like the way we handle fair use under copyright law. There is a statutory provision that says fair use is a thing. It exists. Here are some factors that courts should look into, but leaves the door wide open for courts to engage in the kind of common law reasoning that they are kind of best positioned to do. And that's what we would like to see here. I wouldn't object to Congress saying a digital exhaustion or digital first sale regime is something that we think is appropriate and legitimate. Courts figure it out. I think that is that's about as far as I want Congress to wade into this issue.
So Sarah, were you going to ask something?
Yeah, if you don't mind, I was going to just ask. So Aaron, I should say, I read your full law review article yesterday. It was excellent, the latest one. And I had some thoughts. So my takeaway, I guess, was it seems like your proposal is really about kind of putting the balance back in copyright, and the way that you're going about it is through exhaustion. What I thought was really interesting is it seems like the way that you've created the test with the focus on whether or not the person really parted with access seems like it kind of artificially imposes aspects of the analog world to the digital world, because it's kind of dependent upon treating things that are non-rivalrous as if they were rivalrous. And so I just kind of wanted to ask a little bit about that. It's kind of interesting to me that it feels like it's more of a, like you're trying to apply the rules that apply in the physical world in the digital world. And so it's going to encourage platforms like Redigi. Is that how you pronounce it? I've never actually heard someone say it out loud. where you kind of, you know, artificially are destroying the copies on your that you preserve locally to, in order to give to someone else, which of course isn't actually required. That's not the way, you know, digital access works, but it's us kind of artificially imposing that.
Yeah. So one of the things that we're concerned about is, and this is one of the common critiques that I hear about this proposal is, and I think it's a legitimate worry. Look, if we create digital exhaustion, it's just giving people permission to buy something and make 100 copies of it and send those copies to their friends and keep the copy that they originally downloaded for themselves. Our proposal is one that tries to sort of maintain the one-to-one relationship between items purchased and authorized users or owners of those digital assets. And I hear what you're saying. I mean, in one sense, what we're saying is, look, we want to keep things the way they were in the physical world, right? I actually think that even in the physical world, the particular copy that a person owns plays a somewhat different role than we might imagine. So what we talk about is that the copy, the traditional analog copy and the digital copy really, sort of function as a symbol or as a token, a piece of evidence that says, I'm a person who stands in a special relationship with this work. The copy is the proof that I paid for this thing. And it's not about the inherent physical limitations of the copy itself. You know, we would say that the property right here, the personal property right, is not a right to a thing. It's not a right to the physical book. It is a right to the intangible underlying work, but it's a right that is limited to this purchaser who stands in this special relationship with the work itself. And in some ways, I think that idea is a lot easier to translate to the digital environment, right? So I think what we're trying to advocate for really is a copyright regime that's actually less focused on accounting for copies, right? The sort of obsessive copy counting that we see actually in a case like Redigi, where the court is incredibly concerned with, wait, did you make a new copy when this song was uploaded to the used MP3 server, or did you just move a copy from point A to point B? And what we want to say is that doesn't really matter. What matters is that the rights transfer from one party to another, and that you can't, through a single purchase, create rights in multiple owners. And so in that sense, I think we're actually trying to move away from the physical world analog, but in a way that kind of preserves that structure of the rights to the intangible work. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. That makes perfect sense to me. I guess one thing that was also interesting was you were kind of making the argument there that one reason to do this is that we'll give consumers an incentive to participate in legitimate copyright markets and pay for stuff that they, you know, copyrighted material. And I was a little bit skeptical of that. I guess I wonder whether do you really think that that is enough to kind of compete with free alternatives? Just the fact that they would be getting, you know, legitimate, maybe some more legitimate rights to do what they might otherwise be doing anyway.
So whether it's sufficient, I can't say for sure, right? But the idea is, so I've recently been talking about this project to an audience that I don't have a whole lot of access to, and that's undergraduate students, people who, not to generalize, are not in the habit of paying for content, or at least paying for ownership of content. Maybe they subscribe to Spotify or Netflix. And, you know, what I think I've sort of come away from those conversations understanding is that from the perspective of those consumers, copyright law is asking them to do something that is remarkable, almost irrational, which is, why don't you pay for this thing that's available for free?
Right.
Why would someone do that? And there are a couple of reasons that people might do that. One reason is they're worried about the threat of liability. They're worried about statutory damages. They're worried, you know, about having their internet access shut off, something along those lines. Another reason that they might do it is that they get something of value for their money in exchange for that payment. What do they get of value? There's a certain degree of clarity and stability and kind of legitimacy of rights when you pay for something and you own it. So, you know, to the extent that we present consumers with a choice between pay $10 for this thing and we can take it away at any moment without notice, and maybe we'll issue you a refund or maybe we won't, on the one hand, or pay $10 for this thing, it's yours, you get to keep it forever. If you decide you don't like it and you want to sell it to someone else, you can. If you want to lend it to your friends, you can. And that's a much better value proposition for your $10 than the alternative. I don't know what the marginal difference is going to be in terms of how many consumers we convince to make a purchase under that model rather than the current model. But my sense is it's going to be a net positive. I don't know how big of a net positive, but I do think there's a class of consumers who expect ownership and are willing to pay or willing to pay a premium for it. But that's, granted, sort of an untested hypothesis.
I have a couple of thoughts as I've been listening to the conversation unfold here. And first goes back to our show last week, where we were talking about Vint Cerf's hand-wringing over the potential digital dark age as we are consigning all of our media and assets and memories and intellect to a digital format that may not be universally readable or comprehensible in the future. And secondly, we got a great comment in IRC from Virgil, who asks, what would Vincent Price's character, Dr. Robert Morgan, in The Last Man on Earth have to read, listen to, watch if there were only digital media? So, of course, this is not a question that I really expect you to have the answer to, Aaron, but it is interesting to think about it as we ponder the move of all of our entertainment and scholarship and everything else into digital form. And what I'd like to do now is kind of move away from this realm of ideas we've been talking about these issues into something more concrete, having to do with Bratz dolls, of all things. But before we do that, we actually have, I mentioned at the top of the show, we were going to have another guest join us, and he has. So I want to introduce him and bring him into the conversation. And shortly, we're going to have kind of a changing of the guard because Aaron needs to scoot off, but now we've got Matt with us. So we're going to go on with Matt after Aaron departs. This is Matt Homan, who has just joined us. Matt is an old acquaintance of mine, blogger for a long time, lawyer, very creative thinker, and out-of-the-box kind of thinker. And his recent enterprise is he has launched a couple of apps called Invisible Boyfriend and Invisible Girlfriend that have gotten a lot of attention in the media lately and have raised some issues that I bet, Matt, you never thought you'd be considering at this point.
You know, it's funny. Thank you, Denise. It's good to be here. We just had a pitch to a Washington University MBA executive group. And so we keep on hearing issues that are coming up. I have to remind myself we've only been live for less than 3 months. So bring them on. I don't can answer them all, but we'll give it our best shot.
All right, good. We're going to do that a bit later in the show. We're going to wrap things up in the areas that Aaron is quite well versed in. And we've been talking about reusing things that you've purchased. And this is something that just caught my eye in the last week or so that I thought was so funny and cute. And I think the reason that it was making the rounds in social media is, well, let me tell you what it is first. It's an Australian woman who decided, like many parents might decide, that the Bratz dolls that are available to purchase for your child are not necessarily the best representation or the most honest representation or the most role model worthy representation of femininity that she wanted her family enjoying. So, and she's also just kind of a doll nut and someone who enjoys working with dolls and quite an artist too, because what she decided to do was, she would buy, I think, secondhand dolls, often Bratz dolls in thrift stores and things. And she'd take them home and fix them a bit as far as she was concerned. And she took off all the Bratz dolls' makeup and gave them sort of more reasonable looking eyes and clothing. And she opened up an Etsy shop. You know, originally she was doing it for her own family. And then she opened up an Etsy shop and she cannot keep it stocked. She's constantly making more of these because there's strong demand for someone who wants a modded doll. And that's what she's doing. And so while, you know, my parent friends were sharing this around going, isn't this cool? You know, someone's taken this into their own hands and is giving an alternative to these sort of more dramatically made up and not role model worthy dolls that are available. And while that seems to be the theme that with which this was being shared, I, of course, took a look at it and went, oh my gosh, they're modding dolls now. You know, what are the legal ramifications? What is Bratz going to think about this? Aaron, what do you think Bratz is going to think about this?
Well, first of all, as the father of a three-year-old, I think this is wonderful. So it's a really interesting example of a line that, you know, we've been sort of aware of in our writing on these issues about ownership, and that's the line between first sale and fair use. You know, do we think about this as an exercise of someone's personal property interest in a product that they buy, like reselling might be, or do we think that this is kind of better suited for analysis, you know, in terms of the expressive values that I think are inherent in this sort of product? I'm sure Bratz is not happy about this. They're not happy about it for a few reasons, right? One, I think mostly that it opens them up to, you know, a kind of cultural critique. And to me, that's exactly why this should be analyzed through the lens of fair use. It reminds me of the work of sort of pop action figure artist Suck Lord a little bit. I don't know if you're familiar with Suck Lord's work, but he makes these really amazing sort of action figures by kind of Frankensteining together bits and pieces of lots of toys and making something new out of them, and something that's often sort of subversive and has its own message. And I think this is a similar kind of exercise. And you know, this is, I think, exactly the kind of behavior that, you know, that fair use should be in the business of protecting. Now, fair use doesn't explicitly take into account personal property rights or ownership, but there are ways that courts kind of bring that into the equation. And, you know, here I think the fact that that we have a person who's going out and purchasing these products tells us something, at least, about the impact on the market for Bratz dolls, right? If every one of these critical works involves the purchase of a new Bratz doll, I think that's points in favor of this kind of use from a fair use perspective.
You know, you've pointed out to me, one of the reasons that I do the show, I've done this show for such a long time, is so that we have guests on who will say things like, I don't know if you're familiar with Suck Lord's work. So, you know, made my day with that one. And we're gonna go ahead and make Suck Lord our first MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law. We put these phrases in so that if you're listening for continuing legal or other professional credit, you can go ahead and verify that you've listened to the show if your oversight board requires you to do so. So our first phrase this week is Suck Lord. I know you're going to have to run very, very shortly here, Aaron, and I don't want to let you do it without telling us something about the area in which you are probably the foremost world expert. Tell us about what's going on with athletes and tattoo artists and very, very visible tattoos these days.
Yeah, so I'm really interested and have been for a while about the intellectual property implications of tattooing. So I wrote an article a few years ago that was in the Minnesota Law Review that was based on a bunch of qualitative interviews I did. I went around to tattoo shops around the country and talked to people who work there about, you know, their sense of who owns the kinds of creations that they do when they're collaborating with clients, about how we kind of draw the line surrounding inspiration versus copying. What do they do about it? Tattoos, it's one of these industries that kind of falls into what some kind of, sometimes called the negative spaces of intellectual property law. These realms that are really regulated by informal community norms and not really so much by the legal system. So it's interesting when you do see a dispute, a legal dispute, litigation surrounding tattoos. It's a really, really rare occurrence, and typically it involves a professional athlete because there's a sense that there's a lot of money involved. There's a sense that there's some third party, either a shoe company or an advertising company or a video game company, who can be sued by the tattooer rather than suing their own client. And so we've seen a number of these disputes in recent years. And I think that one of the more interesting things that, has happened is EA, Electronic Arts, has put a program in place where they actually put the onus on the professional athlete on, for example, for Madden. They tell pro athletes in the NFL, look, if you want your depiction in our video game to be accurate with respect to your tattoos, you need to go out and get this release signed by your tattoo artist to sort of clear us from any potential liability. I can see why, from kind of a risk management perspective, EA wanted to do that. I mean, having to litigate one of these cases is an expensive and inconvenient proposition. I think it, in some ways, underestimates the sense in which most tattooers understand that once a client leaves the tattoo shop, they do not have control or don't want control over what a client does with their own body, right? Tattooing is, in many ways, this assertion of control over your body, and it's kind of antithetical to that whole ethos to then say, well, I put this image on your body, so I get to control when and where you display yourself. So these cases, I think, are incredibly rare, but they are a large enough expense that it probably makes sense to be proactive in minimizing that risk.
Definitely. And I too, understand why the gaming companies would want to make sure that they've taken care of that issue. It's almost, you know, just asking for something to come and bite them down the road if they don't. So, but it's very interesting to think that all the things that you have to bear in mind these days because of the way our copyright laws work and because of the way that people's ideas of ownership come into conflict with the way those laws work. So it's been great having you help unpack those issues for us a bit today, Aaron. Obviously, there's much more to discuss. Folks should go out and read the links that we have in our rundown, which include Aaron's current law review article with Jason Schwartz and quite a bit more pertinent information. You can see the links that we've been talking about and reading in advance of the show at delicious.com/thisweekinlaw/299. Aaron, anything else you want to let people know about before we go ahead and let you sign off?
I don't think so. I've probably plugged my work as much as I need to, but it's been a lot of fun, and I really appreciate the opportunity to talk with all of you today. Thanks so much.
Great chatting with you too. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Aaron.
All right. Bye-bye. Take care. Bye.
All right. Well, Matt, wonderful to have you with us. I think now would be a good time for folks to stretch, take a break. Maybe we thank one of our sponsors for this episode of This Week in Law. And the first sponsor we're going to thank is Blue Apron. We talk a lot about Blue Apron on the show. Blue Apron has become a big part of my life, a big part of the way I approach the kitchen and my cooking talents and putting good food on the table for family and friends and sharing great food with folks that come to visit. Or, you know, I've given Blue Apron meals to people for gifts. I've given them to clients at Christmas time. They're just great. For anyone who knows how to cook, doesn't know how to cook, feels fairly comfortable in the kitchen, but wants to bring their cooking skills along. It's really, or, you know, I think probably the best use of Blue Apron is you just like good food and you want to have good, fresh, healthy food in your house. And you don't always want to be eating out all the time. You want it to be available conveniently for you and readily put together. Blue Apron is just awesome for this. And so I know you know a lot about Blue Apron if you've been listening to This Week in Law for some time. I'm a huge fan of the service, having used it for a while. But one thing I have not highlighted for you yet, you know that they send great farm fresh, healthy meals with all the ingredients ready to go and easy step-by-step recipes to follow right to your home, and that the things go together really quickly, 25, 30 minutes sometimes. And then you come out with this great, you know, restaurant-worthy dish at the end of things, and not just an entree, but very often, I think almost inevitably, a great side dish to vegetables and salads and things that go along. So you know all that. You know that the balanced meals that you're getting from this have just 500 to 700 calories a serving, and this is all great, great stuff. But what I haven't highlighted yet is if you are one of those people who wants to increase your skills in the kitchen, maybe you've never done something like poach an egg before. It's going to give you step-by-step instructions how to do that in your recipe card, but there are also some great how-to videos that are short and sweet and very easily taken in that help you hone in on those specific cooking skills. My son recently decided he loves poached eggs, and I went through some trials and tribulations of, you know, I'd never actually poached an egg before. I'm not really an egg for breakfast kind of person, so it wasn't in my repertoire. But look at this trick that they give you on Blue Apron in this little, I think it's like a 42 second long video. I would never have thought to swirl the water like this, the boiling water, and they also have you put vinegar in. I think that helps. And it seals the white around the yolk in a way that I was thinking, oh, do I have to buy special trays or contraptions to cook a poached egg? Nope. All you need is a pot with water and a bit of vinegar and these great directions from Blue Apron. And there's our little egg friend having a very hot float on top of that boiling water. So you really have to check it out if you haven't tried it yet. Current meals, they're offering things that you might get if you get on this quickly are things like matzah crusted chicken with orange, fennel, and golden beet salad, and miso tofu shiitake noodles with roasted eggplant and nasturtium leaves. So again, the flavors they put together are just so incredible. They're probably not things that you would decide to make spur of the moment while you're grocery shopping. They're probably things that you would only decide to make if you're the kind of person who pours through cookbooks and comes up with great looking dishes. They're doing all that for you and sending them right to you. So Blue Apron, it's a better way to cook. Check out this week's menu and get your first two meals free by going to blueapron.com/twit. That's right, two meals just for going to blueapron.com/twit. Thank you so much, Blue Apron, for helping me out in the kitchen and for your support of This Week in Law. Matt, wonderful to have you on the show. It's been far too long.
How are you?
I'm doing great. I know that you've been having a good deal of fun lately.
I have. It has been a little bit crazy the last 3 months, that's for sure.
One anecdote I'll tell folks before we get into talking about invisible boyfriend and invisible girlfriend. Matt is no stranger to having great problem-solving ideas, which is how these apps came about. Matt was recently divorced and had people that were on his back about, you know, when are you going to get yourself in a relationship again? And he wanted to be able to just, you know, get these people off his back and thought it would be really great if I could just show them a bunch of texts from someone, you know, so they believed I was in a relationship. That's how you decided to go down this path?
That's correct. It was that was about nine, almost 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. And then promptly registered the domains invisiblegirlfriend.com and invisibleboyfriend.com and then didn't do anything with them until November of 2013.
Well, I don't know. It was probably 8 or 9 years ago, too, that you told me the great trick of your digital business card instead of having to carry cards around with you. Or, oh, my gosh, what if you didn't have a card with you? You registered the domain imetmatt.com and just put a card up at that domain. So you could just tell people, oh, just look up imetmatt. And
now
there you go.
I think I've got to go back and actually see if I still own that domain. That's such a long time ago when we first met.
I thought that was such a brilliant idea. Great way to just make sure that people can always contact you. All right. So what you've wound up doing is getting people thinking, you know, about virtual relationships in general and how our robot overlords are going to interact with us when we don't actually have human romantic relationships anymore. So we'll play our bumper for that sort of topic. I definitely want to be romantically entangled with one of those little robots. All right. So we teed it up. We gave your original inspiration or what you thought the utility of your apps would be, just kind of, you know, a get off my back kind of thing. And it's turned out to be much more than that. Tell us how you decided to have the app interact with the client, because as I understand it, from what I've read and heard about your service, you started out thinking that a chatbot was going to be sufficient and then quickly decided, no, that's not going to do the trick.
That's right, Denise. We went to Startup Weekend in here in St. Louis in November of 13, and it was really only the last minute that I pitched this idea. Like I said, I've had it for a long time. And in the course of that weekend, we managed to connect up Twilio, which is a text messaging service, and a chatbot. And when we won the Startup Weekend, we thought, oh, this should be pretty easy. We'll just build a better chatbot. We'll find an online service we can use or otherwise connect it and make this really simple text messaging tool. What we realized is that the chatbot just didn't do the trick. You know, when I talk to Siri, half the time she doesn't understand what I'm saying. And when we realize that four-year-olds can essentially do better natural language processing than the most sophisticated computers, we started to look for other options. And we just so happened upon a company here in St. Louis. A friend of mine is the COO, called Crowdsource. And what they do is they do micro tasks for a infinitely scalable workforce. And we talked with them and realized that we could send the text messages from our users through our system to Crowdsource, and we could curate a workforce of about 600 plus people. They get the text message. They see a bit of the context on the conversation. They can understand a bit of the history of how that person was talking with them, what their personality is supposed to be, et cetera. And they respond. And what has surprised us in thinking invisible girlfriend and invisible boyfriend, we're supposed to be proof. All right. It's proof you're in a relationship even when you're not. And more and more of our users are burning through their text messages in a fairly rapid way beyond what they'd need to show someone else. And so we've kind of come in this in-between relationship model. It's we're calling it distributed companionship, but it's halfway between what a robot could do and what a single person could do. And so these individuals have created this fictional person. They know it's fictional. They've not been catfished by someone else who set them up on the service. And they're talking with them, and it's validating, it's interesting to them, and it's been quite a wonderful and interesting experiment over the last 3 months.
Yeah. At first, when you launched, you got quite a bit of attention, quite a bit of, I think, eyebrows raised and heads shaken. You know, have we really come to this kind of response? You were featured on Conan O'Brien, and I think we might have that queued up so that people can see the sort of, I'm sure you loved the exposure, but it girlfriend. Must have been funny to see yes, your product sent up this way.
For guys who are having trouble dating, that are lonely, the company customizes a fake girlfriend that will call, text, and email you for $24.99 a month. $24.99 a month. You'll get texts, emails, phone calls. Yeah. The creator says the service is going to feel very real. I think maybe a little too real. Check out their ad.
Invisible Girlfriend offers lots of exciting add-ons, so your invisible relationship grows just like a real relationship. After 6 months, your invisible girlfriend demands you become Facebook official at an extra $5 a month. After 1 year, it moves in with you for an additional $30 a month. After 2 years, an invisible condom breaks at $500, which leads to an invisible shotgun wedding at just $10,000. Two invisible kids and an invisible terrier mix for just $1,200 a month. After 9 years, invisible alienation of affection at a rate of $17 a month, plus liver damage. An invisible mistress at no additional cost to you. And finally, invisible alimony for 50% of your assets. Invisible girlfriend. Fake love. Real sad.
I just loved that. I loved that you caught their attention and got quite nicely sent up there. So having got all this attention, you have quite a few subscribers now. Can you share with us your subscriber numbers?
We have had the subscriber numbers we're keeping a little close to the vest at this point, but we've had almost 60,000 people who created boyfriends and girlfriends from mm-hmm. around the world. Roughly half of our users are living overseas. Of those, we've had only a small percentage, I'd say a little over 1,000 to 1,500 have actually gone through with the service. What we're finding is that about half of our potential users can't use the service yet because we're only available here in the US and Canada. But yeah, we've had some fun. We've been surveying them. We're learning why they're using the service. And one thing, and the Conan O'Brien thing is funny, but one of the things we've really tried to take seriously is that this is a real problem for people. It's easy to be judgmental about, isn't it sad that someone needs to have proof? They don't mm-hmm. need to have proof for themselves. They need to have proof because in many ways, society is demanding that they be in a relationship. And that somehow you're more valid to our society if someone else has said you're okay to hang out with. And so for those people, folks who just want to focus on their jobs, people who are getting hit on at the office, we think there's lots of people who are interested in having a bit of this service and also using it to have a bit of conversation.
Right. And the proof aspect is certainly, you know, why you went into this, but it's sort of morphed into having a relationship with someone. And as you said, you know, you're not pulling the wool over anyone's eyes. They know it's a relationship that they're paying for. But the folks who've tried it out and written about it oftentimes have been blindsided by how satisfying it was.
That kind of caught us by surprise. We've always told everyone that we're not trying to build a relationship you can believe in. We're trying to give you proof to others. But even as we were in the early beta before we released to the public in January, we started to realize that this real people responding to the text messages was pretty compelling. You know, and the other thing that's been fascinating to me is that when I get a text message from my invisible girlfriend, and I name her invisible girlfriend on my phone so my wife doesn't get jealous, but from my invisible girlfriend, I feel compelled to respond even though I know what's behind the curtain. And so in some ways, technology has trained us in a little bit different way to interact with it than I think we'd suspect. And certainly those conversations, while I don't know that they're relationships necessarily, certainly we're trying to figure out exactly what we've built. But it's validating, it's positive, and it's someone who's always there to give you a response or to prompt you if they haven't heard from you for a while. So it's been pretty cool.
Yeah, it seems like at some point you may have to rebrand or, you know, branch out a little bit and offer the service that is less of a pretense of being a romantic relationship and more just a friendship, a support.
I think that's exactly right, Denise. And it's been, you know, most startups, and this is has been for at least for a while a side project of mine. We've got a team, a handful of our original founders continue to work on the project with me as well, is that you know, most startup founders are would kill for not just the publicity we've got, but the kind of users and ability to get insight. When we launched, we were hoping we might get 50, maybe 100 people to use the service for a couple months so we could learn from them and figure out where we need to go. And that's been the case. We seem like we're solving really two different things. Some people really want it for the proof. We've had some amazing testimonials from folks, from a widower who's getting, you know, got tired of his kids asking when he's going to be dating, from a woman who recently lost her, her boyfriend broke up with her when she was going through chemo. She's using it not for the proof so much as just to have someone to talk to. So we think we've got to figure out exactly where they go. And when you talk about the relationship piece, I think there's other avenues where that conversation and that relationship are equally valid beyond the romantic one.
Right. And the other aspect that seems like it might be incredibly useful and a great value at $25 a month is to have, as you brought up Siri at the beginning of this conversation, a Siri that actually worked. Right? If you're crowdsourcing and humans are responding to your queries, it seems like they would be able to understand and deliver you the information you're actually looking for instead of the wrong restaurant in the wrong town, as Siri is so fond of giving me.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. All right. So I was tweeting earlier this week that you might be the only person other than the Unsullied themselves who know, Game of Thrones reference for the show here, who know why the Unsullied visit brothels, that there is this sort of human contact, support, validation thing. It'd be interesting to have you tell us, and again, it all seems like this is a moving target, but for the time being, your crowdsourced responders, how are you preparing them to deal with the myriad of things they must be getting from your 60,000 plus users?
It's funny, Denise, is that most of the people early on who tried to break the system, who tried to sext with it, who tried to pick fights or otherwise argue or to use profanity, we realized most of those were media people writing about the service, trying to come up with a unique angle to say that I broke my invisible boyfriend's will. Really, we're not seeing that. When we look at what how our users are using it, it's the mundane that is most commonplace. It's not, if our users, if they say something inappropriate, our crowdsource folks can flag that. We've got a handful of flags that we're able to implement, but they're not being used very often. And now that I don't want to say the initial buzz has completely died down, but now that the folks who want to write about it as something brand new have written about it, we're seeing far less of those those kind of outlier use cases because mm-hmm. most people are just they're enjoying talking to someone or having those texts. Maybe they show their friends, but it's been less, there's less variability than we expected. It sometimes is a bit boring, which is kind of cool in some ways.
Yeah, at some level, our chat room thinks this is all a little bit creepy and weird. Sarah, what do you think?
I think it's fascinating, especially the fact that it started as something kind of tongue-in-cheek and it's turning into something more serious. I think it's really interesting. I would love to read your terms of service. Actually, I was just thinking, I just made a note to myself to look at those because that would be interesting. Because I wonder, you know, how often do people start asking for advice or kind of border on things where you're almost getting into like, categories of topics where it'd be good to have a social worker responding. You know, have you kind of gotten into that where people are really in trouble or suicidal or anything like that? Or
we've not seen any of that yet. Terms of service talk about it being for entertainment purposes only, those sorts of things, as you might imagine. But really, we've had folks who've reached out to us who would love to figure out how we can use this on a mental health standpoint. It's something that we're not prepared for. We certainly aren't making any promises. But the conversation isn't really about, maybe I'm bummed or it's a little down day, but it's not, at least what we're seeing so far, anything at the extreme either way. We have had people, we talked to our users quite a bit and trying to figure out why they're using it. We had one user who said that she was practicing her flirting with her invisible boyfriend so she could then use it on a prospect for hers. Another guy said that he used it to make a woman that he was seeing jealous. Been at a date with her. His text message came through from his invisible girlfriend, left the phone on the table as he went to the restroom. And when he came back, she was far more intrigued by him than she might have been before. So it's all of those use cases that we're really still trying to sort out. And I do think there's multiple avenues for that. We certainly have the capacity at some point in the near future to add perhaps mental health professionals, to add nurses, to add other folks who might be more equipped to deal with the outlier comments. We just haven't gotten there yet and haven't seen really any of them that have given us a significant moment for pause.
Well, I don't mean to sit here and give you moments for pause, but, you know, I tend to look at your adventure here from a bar exam issue spotting kind of perspective, you know, what could happen.
It comes with a degree, doesn't it, a little bit, Denise?
Right. It does, unfortunately. So I've been mulling about, you know, your secondary liability kinds of exposure and the fact that, well, let me ask you, are you monitoring every single response that every single crowdsource worker sends out, or are you just giving them guidelines and turning them loose?
So it's a bit of both. One of the things with the number of text messages we have is that we're obviously keeping an archive. One of the things that crowdsource does for us, and it's one of the really valuable things of their service, is they've built an entire quality assurance rigor around the service that they're providing. So we've got multiple points of chances to catch things. It has been, you know, we haven't really seen them tested yet. I know that someone's going to come in and whether they're a user or they're a journalist and, you know, try and break it or say something that's interesting, but it hasn't happened yet. And that's one of the things being in beta, you know, we're in early beta. We've barely been around for 90 days, is that we can start layering more artificial intelligence and even having an extra set of eyes when necessary. Mm-hmm. But we're all, you know, those are all on the punch list. We're trying to figure out what we prioritize and how to do it. So few startups get this kind of publicity, much less this kind of interest from folks all across the spectrum, not just the traditional startup press. So every bit of advice we get, we listen and we figure out how we can act upon it.
I'm less concerned with the journalists trying to, you know, work the system, trying to see if they can push it to make the virtual boyfriend break up with them or what have you. As just, you know, the lull, as you said, the kind of boring conversations where everyone's not really thinking about the ramifications of what might be going back and forth. And let's just, you know, harken back to the earlier part of the show where we're talking about the confusion of people, whether they own their digital media, what they can do with their digital media. What if someone's sitting at home with a conundrum about, you know, they've clicked the buy now button on a book and they want to make some use of it, or you know, they've purchased HBO's service, but they're not at home and they can't watch, and they're going to download Game of Thrones illegally because they've already bought it, right? And they know, they feel good about the fact they've already paid for it, and they just decide to vet it through their invisible girlfriend to say, you know, I already bought this. Yeah, I should be able to download it, right? And they go, yeah, why not? And there you are, you know, secondary liability inducing infringement with a paper trail.
So if I ask that of someone while I'm sitting in a cocktail party, Denise, mm-hmm. and we're sitting having a cocktail and they give me that advice, are they liable as well?
Yeah, but there's no paper trail. I don't know. No, I don't think they necessarily are. But I do think that, you know, the whole notion of an unauthorized practice of law, or as Sarah brought up, maybe counseling
situations.
Well,
first of all, from an unauthorized practice of law thing, Denise, yeah. I mean, none of us, you know, I'm no longer practicing. This is one of those things, and this is always what has driven me crazy about the lawyers that I've worked with, my friends, mm-hmm. even myself, is that we see that one out of 1,000 handshake deals that go badly. And mm-hmm. we tell every single one of our clients, you have to paper the heck out of it because they all seem like they're going to go badly. And at some point, you know, it's interesting, and this is from a startup standpoint. There's all kinds of startups out here who have you see what they're doing and you wonder what their liability is, but it doesn't always come to fruition. We're trying to figure this stuff out, but yeah, the moment that we sit down and say, what are all the things that could possibly go wrong? Let's make a long list. No one builds a company. No one starts anything anymore.
Absolutely. And I don't mean to grind you to a halt that way. I'm just, you know, sort of having fun with the issues that occurred to me. And I do not mean to have you guys shut the doors until you've
Oh, I'm sorry, Denise. We just turned it
dealt
off.
Dealt with and anticipated. The other thing that that has come up in some of the coverage of the service is the fact that people, you know, whether they're using the service as a cover to demonstrate they're in a relationship or whether they're using their $25 a month as a more psychologically validating pseudo relationship, they are disclosing personal details about themselves in order to get better feedback from the crowdsourcers who are responding. You know, they're telling names of people they live with, their pets, maybe where they live, what they're doing, all kinds of things that would be considered pretty sensitive personal information. How are you dealing with that data?
Well, one of the things that's interesting is that the way that the crowdsource mechanism works for us is that it's not the same person that you, is your boyfriend or girlfriend all the time. So the kind of information that someone might glean in a multi-threaded month-long conversation with you is really not, you know, no one has access from the crowdsource standpoint from those individual workers to that data. They see just enough to give them context, and they don't see any more than that. We also are working to scrub out kind of phone numbers and other personally identifying information, but there's not enough of that context going back and forth with the crowdsource workers. You know, they're not going to be falling in love with our invisible boyfriends and girlfriends or with their real boyfriends and girlfriends, even though we've got a bunch of reality shows that seem to make one to think that's happening and want to feature us. we've got the privacy policy, we've got the terms of service, and it's one of the coolest things as having the legal background is to realize that we've built something that is actually raising some of these interesting concerns far beyond the "are you seeing someone" question that we were trying to answer to begin with. We don't know the answers to all of those things, and hopefully we'll be able to solve for them before anything happens, even though I don't really see those possibilities short term for us. Knocking on wood underneath this table here, just for the record.
Yeah, absolutely. Sarah, what has crossed your legal mind as you've been considering Matt's company?
Well, one thing that just occurred to me as we were talking was this. It's interesting to think about the differences in potential liability from a platform that would actually just be connecting random users. So like connecting people that are all looking for an invisible girlfriend and having them kind of interact versus what you're doing, which is people, you know, public comes in and you have this quality assurance crowdsourced group of specified people that are dealing with the public. So it's kind of interesting to think about, and I don't know the answers off the top of my head, but it's just interesting to think about the potential differences in liability because of that, because you're actually exerting some control or some attempts to control the quality. Does that up your risk at all? I mean, one would hope not, but I kind of wonder.
It's interesting, Sarah, when you talk about that, because at the other end of the spectrum, a decision that we had to make, at least early on, was that there was the potential ability to just connect random users through our service and have them, you know, have one play the role of the invisible boyfriend, have the other play the role of the invisible girlfriend, you know, kind of at each side of the V, if you think of it that way. Right. And that seemed to be really posing far more problems because how do you do quality assurance? How do you figure out how to make sure that invisible and the other person don't live in the same city and actually have that connection and something terrible happens? So that's one of the reasons why we went with the crowdsource, is it gives us an opportunity for a bit of quality assurance, quality control. We get to monitor our users. If folks are not responsive, if they're not doing the things that we think they should do, we can move on and disqualify them from our workforce. I really wonder, and I'll turn this back to both of you, is that if we had a service that literally crowdsourced not from the company but from our users on both sides of the boyfriend and girlfriend site, what kind of liability do you see if we're just providing the tunnel for them to talk with one another?
I mean, in that case, it's similar to like a Craigslist or any other platform where it's really just about, you know, what people upload, and there's no kind of, you know, other than stuff that's been identified, then they'll take down, but they're not proactively upfront doing quality control. So it seems like it would be fall into that category. What do you think, Denise?
Yeah, I think it's actually maybe better from the corporate standpoint to structure something that way, because then you might be able to look to the DMCA or the Communications Decency Act to say, hey, you know, we're just a third party. We're not responsible for what our users do. You'd take flack for bad situations, as Twitter has, and you'd probably have to have some anti-harassment steps that would be taken. But it seems like, you know, when the company is actually providing the responses, that's a whole different ball of wax. And it takes out of the equation these third-party protections that are in place for sites that just allow users to communicate with each other.
I want to thank you both for that official legal advice rendered to a company here in Missouri from folks in other jurisdictions. We'll rely upon that to your detriment.
Yeah, no, not at all. Nothing legal advice flowing here, of course, but a fun conversation. And what else did I want to ask you about? Oh, as long as we're talking about crowdsourced labor, it is an interesting situation you find yourself in. You're not hiring the crowdsourcers. You're not monitoring the crowdsourcers. This is a third party site that you've handled. But your product and the publicity it's gotten has brought some attention to crowdsourced labor and has, you know, gotten people thinking about how they're paid, et cetera. Of course, crowdsourced labor is nothing new anywhere in the world. It exists sort of everywhere universally, and anyone who's ever called customer service has had that experience. Do you have any additional insights for us on that front, Matt?
I think the thing for us is that, you know, maybe in a perfect world, had we, you know, built a business, slowly grew it, we might have thought about, you know, using our own people to do this. But it was really the only way for us, if we wanted to use real people to respond to text messages, it was the only way for us to scale this business up as quickly as we have to serve the users we have. And our second day when we were on the Today Show, 3 days after launch, you know, we sent 20,000 text messages. Mm-hmm. And within a 12 to 14 hour period. So for us, it was a business driving impediment or a business driving thing to do, not so much around, is this the absolute best way to solve this with unlimited resources or unlimited time? And the fact that crowdsource is local for us, they're just across the river here. I'm in St. Louis, Missouri. They're just on the Illinois side. We're probably, at least for a while, their smallest customer, but we know them. There's been an amazing amount of support for us here in the St. Louis, Missouri community. And when we talk with them, they've been nothing but a fantastic partner for us.
So because of the way that this did come out of the gate marketed as a virtual romantic relationship, I'm sure you do run into situations where users try and get more romantic with your crowdsourced responders than is permissible. Do you just cancel their account at that point? What's the response when that happens?
It's amazing is that it doesn't happen, or it happens hardly at all. Mm-hmm. We don't, in terms of service, we don't allow sexting. So if someone mm-hmm. were to send that, we can flag their account. We'll suspend them for a day or so. If they are a repeat offender, we can cancel their account. But mm-hmm. it's surprisingly the way where everyone wants to go. It's like, oh, people are going to send dirty messages to the stranger. It hasn't been happening. And since the media has stopped writing all the stories when we had, you know, probably 200 media accounts out there, it's rare for us to even see a single one of those inappropriate flags come through from crowdsource.
Right. It's more kind of an impression that I think people would have from the relationship. It's like that in one of the articles we have in the discussion points, and people, you should check these out because there's been some really interesting writing about Matt's service and people musing about it. Someone decided it would be interesting to interview one of the crowdsourcers and see what it's like, you know, to be on that side of this relationship. And one of the things that she said was, you know, happy to be doing it, decided she's a female, but she plays the boyfriend in the relationship because she feels like she has a good insight into what she would be wanting to hear back from someone in a relationship. And everything's all hunky-dory except for her 16-year-old son, who just kind of goes like this and says, "Mom, it's like you're working for a 900 number." Do you, you know what I'm talking about? Another writer has characterized it as prostitution without sex. Do you have concerns about that kind of impression, Matt?
You know, there's a huge amount of judgment and bias that we kind of carry with us. And one of the things we've been really careful and adamant about it from the very beginning is that we're solving something real for our customers. I think lots of that criticism comes from that judgmental piece of, you know, you must be creepy or you must be needing something in a strange way that's not normal to want to talk to someone who's positive, validating, or to have cover from everyone else like me who's judging you that you're not in a relationship. So right. It doesn't feel that way to us. And again, one of the things you notice, and certainly you guys see it in your practices as well, is that you know, there's the one in a thousand or the one in a million people who will, if it's possible to take it the wrong way, they will. Mm-hmm. But it hasn't, and I feel like I'm a broken record here. It isn't something we're seeing our users worry about. And they're not complaining about. It's the media who's thinking like we are just now of the furthest fetched concept they can come up with and then say the service is terrible because it will support something that, frankly, no one's using it for.
Right. Interesting question from IRC. They're wondering if you have numbers or can share numbers on whether the majority of your users are male or female.
We've had roughly 65% are women. The other 35% are men. And then we also have about 10% of our users have chosen same-sex partners.
So that breaks down pretty reflective of actual population. That's really interesting.
It really does. One thing that has been interesting, though, is that when we look to folks from other countries who have built their boyfriends or girlfriends but who can't buy the service yet, different countries seem to have different breakdowns. So those numbers come from our actual users here in the U.S. And it does, like you said, it tracks with kind of what you would expect.
Mm-hmm. Did that jibe with your expectations when you launched that you have more women users than men? Did you expect to see that?
I think that especially after we won the startup weekend, one of the reasons why we did Invisible Girlfriend first is we knew we couldn't build both of them in the 54 hours of time that we had to launch and pitch. And most of the judges, I think all but one were men. So, and a fair number of the participants in the startup weekend were men. So we thought we'd have a better shot building a girlfriend than a boyfriend to begin with. But we've always felt that boyfriend is probably a more potentially viable service compared to the other, because there's so much more judgment, it seems, on women for their lack of a relationship partner than there is for men, especially the hitting on, you know, getting hit on at the office, the harassment, those sorts of things. And in fact, we had a user who said, that she had a coworker who was continually making unwelcome advances to her the moment that she signed up for the service. She was able to provide the picture and the text messages and the voicemails, and he finally started to leave her alone.
Wow, that's pretty cool. Sarah, any other things you want to pick Matt's brain on here?
I don't think so. The one thing I wanted to kind of respond to was, Matt, I completely appreciate your point about not like the judgmental piece, and I think that's a really important point because it's easy to kind of be dismissive of, oh, isn't this sad that these people need this kind of companionship? But it's really similar to what we're all doing all the time on social media, which is looking for validation from strangers and or people on Facebook who we maybe knew a million years ago, but we don't, you know, I mean, why is it different? It's like there's a real need for human connection there and that you're providing. So I think that that's an important point.
Thank you.
And what's your response to some of the people like Lucy Tobin, who wrote about your service in the London Evening Standard, who thinks, you know, this is one of the horsemen of the apocalypse that, you know, once we all start getting into virtual relationships, it's everything goes downhill from here. And she gives some other extreme examples like, will the unemployed soon be offered the chance to pay for a fake boss to post pretend paychecks and fool their family into thinking they've found a new job, et cetera? What is your response to that?
Well, that last one might be about 10th down the list on our roadmap of other services we want to launch. You know, if we're the fourth, if there's four horsemen in the apocalypse, we're bringing up the rear and we might be the pony at the end. For this to be one of those indicators that the world is coming to an end, I think there's so many more things that if we're it, we're in serious trouble and we might as well be billionaires. So it's hard to agree, at least with the service we have now. I mean, that's a real thing, is that it's easy for people to forget, and sometimes for us to forget, that this is brand new. This is, you know, we thought we might have 100 customers by now, 3 months in if we were lucky, and trying to figure out where the pricing fit and how we find those customers. And so, you know, Forbes magazine even said that this is a shockingly big idea. That all of that stuff is surprising to us, and it's obviously a bit of incentive to figure it out. But if the world is ending because of us, at least that gives me a more interesting epitaph on my gravestone.
Absolutely. Let's see. I think I've about asked you everything I wanted to ask. I just think it's so fascinating, the journey that you're on here, and ask that maybe you come back on the show 6 months, a year from now, and tell us what else you've learned from this process. Because I do think there's a lot to learn here from the way that people are using your service and responding to your service. And that'll be interesting to watch it unfold.
I would love that. And I have known you since, I think, about the time before you started even doing the show. Yeah. I know this isn't 300. When do you officially go into syndication and make all your billions of dollars? For syndication, but congratulations on episode 300, even if it's a episode early.
Thank you so much. Yes, that will be next week, and we appreciate it. We're gonna give a tip and a resource of the week and get on out of here. Matt, if you have things to do, you know, as a busy startup founder, I'm more than willing to give you permission to leave class early if you need to. If not, you're more than welcome to stay on with us as we wrap up the show. Just let me know what you need to do.
I will run, but I want to thank you, Denise. As one of the folks who was blogging earlier than just about any other lawyer, you're an inspiration to lots of us. And really, my career wouldn't have changed in the way that it has had I not seen early innovators like you doing what you do. The non-billable hour doesn't get as much attention as it used to for me, but I can trace directly proximate cause type tracing, starting blogging, to everything that I'm doing now. And I just want to thank you for all your inspiration over the years.
Oh, that's so very sweet. Thank you so much. And I've really enjoyed knowing you over the years as well. And it's been really gratifying to see you embark on this new stage of your career. So best of luck with it.
Thank you, Denise.
And we'll let you go.
Bye-bye.
Now we're going to thank our second sponsor for this episode of This Week in Law, and that is FreshBooks. It's amazing how many lawyers I know who spend too much time practicing paperwork rather than practicing law. On top of their piles of affidavits and case files, there are billable hours that need tracking, expenses to manage, and client invoices to prepare and send. FreshBooks can make your life a little bit easier. And as a solo practitioner myself, I can tell you that FreshBooks literally manages that entire financial piece of my practice for me. The capturing of time, the sending out invoices, and the keeping track of things when I'm on the go. Because with the FreshBooks app, I can manage time even when I'm not sitting at my workstation in my office. I can capture expenses simply by snapping a picture of the receipt and having it incorporated into the invoice. It is the super simple accounting software that is based in the cloud and gives thousands of lawyers like you the tools to save time billing and get paid faster. FreshBooks lets you create and send super slick invoices online in minutes. Tracking your time has never been easier. I mentioned the mobile app. You can track your billable hours from literally anywhere. And let's face it, all of us in today's world are oftentimes working even when we're not in our office. Plus, FreshBooks mobile apps help you organize receipts when you're running between the office, a client meeting, and the courthouse. If you do have questions, the award-winning FreshBooks support rock stars are waiting. There's a real live person on the other end of the phone to help. So go ahead and get started. It's very, very simple, and it's totally free for 30 days with no obligation. Go to FreshBooks.com/Twill, and don't forget to enter Twill in the How Did You Hear About Us section. Start your 30-day free trial today. And we thank FreshBooks for supporting this episode of This Week in Law. All right. Well, if Matt's former legal blog doesn't get the attention that it used to, let's make it our second MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law to give it a little more attention. It's called The Unbillable Hour. And now we've got two phrases in the show. Hooray. We are going to give you a tip and a resource. We're sticking with our theme of Creative Commons related tips from Sarah. Yay. And this week, we've discussed, just to recap, we've discussed a bit about what Creative Commons licenses are, how you use them, how you find Creative Commons licensed work, but we haven't yet touched on why, if you are an artist, you would want to apply a Creative Commons license. So Sarah, can you bring us up to speed?
Sure. So on the public interest side, I think it's obvious why Creative Commons licensing is a good thing. It, you know, gives people this pool of content that they can reuse and remix. But it's interesting from the artist and creator side to think about the reasons why you would do it. And I think some of it, it's kind of interesting to have this follow the discussion with Aaron, because what he is talking a little bit about, especially in his Law Review article, is how this massive exertion of control over copyrighted work is kind of decreasing the incentive for people to actually pay for content, pay for copyrighted works, because there's also, you know, this availability of so much that's free out there. And so CC licensing is kind of a way to combat that. It enables you to, you know, have your content move around the web freely without any copyright concerns while also retaining rights over your work. So it's a way of kind of giving people what they want, but still retaining ownership. I think it was Cory Doctorow that famously said his biggest problem as an artist isn't piracy, it's obscurity. And so that's, you know, another kind of a reason why you might look to CC licensing.
All right. Thanks so much. We're going to continue on helping you understand CC licensing and their use and how they can benefit you as an artist, how they can benefit you as a person who wants to reuse others' material. It's a great resource that we love to give attention to and more understanding. So our resource of the week, we've been talking about Matt's terms of service and how important they are that they be tailored to what they're doing there at Invisible Boyfriend and Invisible Girlfriend. And I think that's a very concrete example of why copying someone else's terms of service and privacy policy and everything else is a really bad idea. And our resource, and it happens all the time, despite what a bad idea it is. So our resource of the week is by Lila Bailey, who has a great Medium piece in very digestible terms. She gives five good reasons why you don't want to do this. I think having our discussion today with Matt should be added in as a sixth, that, you know, different companies do different things and have all kinds of legal considerations that they might want to be taken care of or addressing in their terms of use and privacy policy. And you simply can't adopt one company's, even if they're a similar company to the one that you're operating and use it as your own. It's not unusual to find terms of use on people's sites, sometimes people's fairly well-known sites, that you can tell have been cut and pasted because someone didn't quite get out the last company's name, for example, in the terms of service when they decided to adopt them as their own. So some of the things that Lila highlights are the bad PR you could get if someone figures out, whoops, you just copied that from Yahoo. That's not a good thing. That also, you know, not only bad PR to the public, but your investors and others who are involved in your business might very rightly think that if you're copying other people's terms of service, you know, what other shortcuts are you taking? Really, and this is an important one. She says that good policies can be an asset. It's an opportunity to distinguish your company from the competition. Really, you can head off a lot of potential problems with these things if they're granted properly or they're drafted properly. So bear that in mind too. And examples too are if you make them easy to read and a little bit funny, as Lila points out, people appreciate that. Nobody likes to read these things, but sometimes it's important to do so. And if you can make that, you know, something that actually is a positive representation of your company, that's a great way to go. She also points out it's illegal to, you know, we talk a lot about copyright on this show. And if you're wholesale adopting something that someone else has drafted, I guess we could argue a little bit about whether terms of service and privacy policies qualify as a creative work. But I think that you would find if push came to shove that you would have some copyright problems if someone decided to get nasty with you over it. And if you have, the other thing to really bear in mind is that different jurisdictions have different requirements. Again, you're not really taking into account those issues if you're just copying and pasting. And if you have an invalid term, it could make it so that all of your terms of service are invalid. And then you're worse off than you were when you started. So great thing to bear in mind, and a good piece by Lila Bailey on that front. Sarah, this has been such a fun show. I'm so glad that we got the chance to chat with these guys.
Yeah, me too. It was a good one.
And next week, we're going to have our 300th episode. You know, it's just another episode. It's not really going to be a big deal or anything, but it is fun to hit that milestone. And we're hoping that you guys join us for that. If you do so, you'll be doing that at 11 o'clock Pacific time, 1800 UTC. That's when we record the show live. If you can't join us live, don't worry about it. All the shows are available for you in on-demand form at twit.tv/twill. Also, we have a YouTube channel if that's easier for you, youtube.com/thisweekinlaw. We have various social media presences. You can find us on Facebook, on Google+, and Sarah and I individually are on Twitter. There's a Twitter account for the show as well, but it's a bot. I don't really monitor it. It just puts out the new episodes of the show as they are available. So if you're just looking for where the episodes are, you just want a quick link, then you can go to twitter.com/thisweekinlaw, because that's what you're going to find there. Otherwise, I'm Dee Howell on Twitter, and Sarah is S. Hinch Pearson there. And that's a great way to let us know things that are on your mind about what we've talked about, guests you think we should invite on, companies you think we should pay attention to, whatever you think is a great thing to have on our radar. You can hit us up there or in email. Sarah is Sarah P at twit.tv, and I am D Howell at twit.tv. And with that, we'll go ahead and wrap up the show. We've had a lot of fun. Thank you so much to Matt Homan and Aaron Perzanowski for joining us today. And we'll see you next week on This Week in Law. Take care.